Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. The all-new Opel Mokka. With a new visor front face and pure panel interior, this is Opel.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
From tomorrow, Premiership Football League clubs in England will join in a four-day boycott of social media platforms to combat abuse and discrimination. And just last week, the International Olympic Committee confirmed athletes would not be allowed to take a knee or protest against human rights abuses on the podium of Tokyo 2020 after two-thirds of 3,000 athletes supported a ban. So the question is, can sports and politics coexist? And while we're all familiar with GAA stars moving into local and national politics at times, should athletes feel an obligation to engage in activism? Well, to discuss all of this, I'm joined now by Owen McDevitt from Second Captains and Sinead O'Carroll, editor at thejournal.ie. You're both very welcome. Thank you for joining us on this fascinating topic. Owen, we'll start with those developments that I just outlined there, because it seems contradictory that the International Olympics Council is banning protests and then you have the English soccer clubs activating this social media ban.
Yeah, contradictory is one way of putting it. I mean, it feels a bit like the Olympic Council have their, or the IOC, I should say, have their head in the sand here and don't appear to have noticed what's been happening in the last couple of years, which is that the athletes have found their voice. I was going to say found their voice again, because there has been athlete activism over the years and over the decades, going back to Muhammad Ali and more, but there really has been a resurgence in the last couple of years. And when the IOC say things like, we don't have political demonstrations at our events, we don't have them on the podium, this kind of thing, I mean, they say that what they really mean by political is, what we're talking about here, I think anyway, is, it's human rights we're talking about. It's humanity. It's not, like, they like to use the term political because it's almost like as a sports fan, sometimes you recoil at that because you go, yeah, we don't really want politics involved in sport. But really what it is the real world. And the real world and sport, it's all part of the same thing. You know, sport can't exist in a bubble. And in the last couple of years in particular, it hasn't been existing in a bubble. And we see that with what's going on with the social media boycott over the last couple of days. John, I actually think this is going to be a big backlash as we get closer to the Olympics. Already, the US Olympic Committee says it's not going to sanction its athletes if they do protest on the podium. Team GB athletes, there's murmurings from there, from Great Britain, that they might still look at ways of protesting on the podium and, yeah, and at the ceremony. So I'm not sure. I think there will be a backlash. I think the IOC has misread the tea leaves a little bit here.
Well, it would be strange, I suppose, if there wasn't a backlash. Sinead, can you see or can you explain what the IOC is trying to do by saying that these protests can't happen?
It's trying to do the impossible, really, Claire, because trying to separate, like you said there, can politics and sport coexist? How can they not coexist? The mere presence of some people at the Olympics will be seen as political by some people. And like there, as Owen said, there's loads of examples of that. The presence of black people over the years has been seen as political. It's only been recently we've seen women in hijabs at the Olympics, and that is seen as political. The first gay athletes on the American team at the last Winter Olympics was seen as a movement. To some people, that would have been political. So people's mere presence in sport means that there is fight for human rights, there's fight for equality, and that has always been thus. And actually what the IOC is really wrong about is that they're generally, they're transcendent athletes. They're the people who we know, they're the people who we remember, Jesse Owens, Muhammad Ali, the more recognisable recent ones, Marcus Rashford, Colin Kaepernick, the people who bring themselves into realms that people see as political, but actually it's just them taking the idea of being role models to the next level.
Okay, and we're going to talk about some of those individuals as we go through all of this. But going back, Owen, to the social media ban, the English soccer clubs, it's not just around racial abuse. And I want to talk to you about Aaron Connolly, who's had a difficult time at Brighton. And this was about his on-pitch performance.
Yeah, Aaron Connolly just missed a couple of chances recently and was subjected to some online abuse, the exact details of which we don't know, but it was enough for his coach, Graham Potter, to speak out about it. So that one was nothing to do with race or anything like that. A lot of them are racial. I mean, the amount of black footballers, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Raheem Sterling, you name them. Callum Robinson is another, an Irish international recently, who was abused. And it seems like black footballers now, and there's plenty of female footballers as well have been abused in recent times. It seems like with black footballers, whether they score a goal, do their job correctly as it's seen, or do their job badly, what, as long as they're, as soon as they're noticed, it seems like they're then a target. They're seen as a legitimate target by some people online for abuse. And what's happening here is that essentially the footballers and the clubs and the leagues, and it's not just like cricket, other sports have actually joined it. They're all coming together to try to get the, essentially just get the social media companies to be more proactive. They've tried this now for the last while, but they feel the social media companies aren't essentially doing enough to protect them, and it's kind of hard to disagree with that, Donna.
Just want to talk to you both about the Super League controversy. It was only last week, wasn't it? But some of the players were very vocal on that, and I just wonder, is that activism, or is that seeing which way the wind was blowing? And maybe for some of them it was protecting what they have in terms of their salaries, their ability to transfer with high fees and so on. Sinead, where do you place the outrage that was expressed by some of those top players to the notion of the Super League?
I think a lot of it, and more cynical people might think differently, but I do think a lot of it was looking at where they come from themselves, you know, and seeing football as, you know, a game for them as kids, for the kids now, and football clubs as being local entities. So I do think a lot of it was coming from a place of activism that, you know, football clubs should belong to communities, and the Super League really was the antithesis of that. People like Patrick Bamford, who, you know, in his reaction to it, obviously disagreed with it, but also said if the people who held the purse strings cared as much about problems in the game like racism, then we could be moving on these things a lot better. So I do think that there was genuine activism in a lot of the response, not just minding their own sector.
Owen, do you agree?
Yeah, Claire, just on that, I mean, like, put yourself in the position, anyone listening can put themselves in the position of James Milner, for example, the Liverpool footballer who was interviewed after the Leeds match on Monday night, and this is when the prospect was still alive that the Champions, that the European Super League was going to go through. Liverpool had been one of the clubs who had pushed for it. They were one of the breakaway clubs involved. James Milner, the Liverpool captain on the night, did the interview post-match, and he said, he was asked about it, and he said, "I don't like it, I don't think it should happen," which was an extraordinary moment for me, that a player would go against his employer in that way. And we've seen this in, I mean, Marcus Rashford had gone against the Prime Minister of his country, you know, seen there is a bravery involved in this. And you do get this all the time, this accusation that footballers are in some way piggybacking on social causes to try to gain popularity. But there are easier ways to gain popularity, I think, as an already famous person.
Well, yeah, you're a footballer, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't have to do
exactly.
It, is
you're
your
already,
point.
You're already quite popular. Yeah. And, you know, you are putting a target on your back when you get involved in this kind of stuff. But I think the likes of Milner and that speaking out against the wishes of the people who actually pay their wages was a pretty big deal.
Okay, fair point. But let's talk about some of the individuals who are remarkable in this context now. And Marcus Rashford, I know, Sinead, you mentioned him. Owen, will you just take us through exactly what he tackled and why he was so successful at tackling it?
Well, what he tackled was an issue last year during coronavirus, where the school meal vouchers that are given to kids and poverty-stricken kids in the UK, in England specifically, weren't going to go ahead through the summer holidays. So when COVID hit, the vouchers were getting sent out, or meals were getting sent out to the homes, and these kids were still getting fed. These kids who needed this means to get food in their bellies were still getting it, but it wasn't going to happen during the summer holidays until Marcus Rashford got involved. He wrote an open letter to MPs detailing his own experience, which was that he had to use these kind of facilities. His mother worked as hard as she could, but single mum, had five children and struggled to feed them at times. So he detailed that in this open letter, and he had an amazing line. He said, "This is not about politics, this is about humanity. Political affiliations aside, could we not all agree that no child should be going to bed hungry?" Which obviously really hit home and really cut through a lot of the bull when you hear sporting organisations talking about politics. So, as he says, it was about humanity. And he managed to pressure Boris Johnson and the government to install that voucher system through the summer.
Across the summer.
And he kept going. He did it again. He kept the pressure going. And since then, he had a petition that had over a million signatures, I should say, and the system has been has essentially gone through to this year as well during the various holidays, and he's got various other expansions. So he's been phenomenally successful. And I think part of the reason he was so successful was he took on a very specific cause there. You know, it was he zeroed in on one specific thing where he thought, rather than just generally saying that we want more equality or We want, you know, we want a better society to live in. He found an area that he thought he could make a difference in, and he felt a personal connection.
Yeah, and
to.
It could measurably impact and affect.
Exactly.
And you mentioned his own personal experience. Here he is speaking to the BBC last year about what for him prompted this campaign.
You know, my mum, she done the best she could. I remember we used to go to a shop called Pound World, and everything was under a pound, and you know, we sort of schedule out the week, so we'd get 7 yogurts and you can have 1 yogurt a day and so on. So she done the best she could within the circumstances, but there's some families out there like me that have 4 or 5 kids, so it's literally impossible for her to take control of the situation. You know, that this is all going on at a time where kids should be concentrating on schoolwork and stuff like that, and it's just crazy to think that this is still going on at this, you know, we're in 2020 now, and it's just something that I don't believe should be happening.
It's Marcus Rashford. And Sinead, you want to talk to us about the Williams sisters in tennis as an example of sports stars that you feel have exemplified this approach too.
Yeah, and Venus Williams herself has said that she believes athletes should serve as role models, and she really, you know, put her money where her mouth is from the very start. One of her big fights was for gender pay equality in the sport, and she always said herself it wasn't necessarily about the cash. When she won Wimbledon, she got about £30,000 less than the male winner that year in 2000, but she wanted it to start a movement, and she's continued to work on that. She's just finished playing at 41, but she's still working on gender pay gap in America as a whole. But she took on the most traditional and male organisations. She had famous meetings with people in Wimbledon and the French Open to argue for pay parity. And she was doing all this while, as I mentioned earlier, her presence in tennis was seen as political. Her black body was commented on, and she was paving the way. And I think this is probably one of the best gifts you could think of giving your little sister. She paved the way for Serena just to be able to play and win like she did, be the absolute superstar that she was, and carve out her own path. And that has led to people like Naomi Osaka. There'd be no Naomi Osaka right now without the Williams sisters going ahead of her. And Naomi Osaka is very much in the Marcus Rashford mold of, you know, looking at her place now as a huge superstar, in a transcendent superstar in the world of sport, and looking at how she can make a difference at the US Open. Last year, she wore masks with the names of people who had been killed, people of colour who had been killed by police. And she said she did that because she wanted to make people start talking about it. So she, at a very young age, has started taking on causes and ideas that she wants people to see her as someone to follow.
And then someone else, speaking of Naomi and what you were saying there, 2016, we go back to when American footballer Colin Kaepernick first took the knee to protest about police brutality and racism, Owen. That stance went on to inspire people all around the world. It's still doing it today. There's still controversy as to who does it, who doesn't do it, what it means and so on.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary moment. He sat, apparently for the first couple of games, he actually sat down during the anthem. That was his protest. But I think, in fact, maybe he realised nobody really noticed, you know. So he talked to some people about how he could do it effectively, and he decided just to kneel during the anthem, as you say, to protest police brutality and racial injustice. A lot of people put different meanings on us. A certain former president of the United States, who has recently finished in office, will be a chief among them, you know, that they basically were saying that this is, you know, you're disrespecting our flag, for some reason you're disrespecting our military. I don't know where that even came into it. Mm-hmm. But, like, this is the kind of stuff, and this is, again, to emphasise how these people are brave in doing what they did, because Colin Kaepernick took all that abuse and had to deal with it. He hasn't played for anybody. He was made a free agent at the end of that season when he started doing that protest. And he's effectively been blackballed from the NFL since then. He's never been signed by another team. And the whole taking a knee sort of as a means of a protest has been rejuvenated really in the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd. And that's actually what, if you remember, the Premier League footballers, well, they still do it today, but it was a really big moment when they came back from lockdown last year. And Sheffield United against Aston Villa was the first game. And the players took a knee before the first whistle. And it was a huge thing because people weren't sure what was going to happen and how the protests are going to manifest themselves in the Premier League. And actually from that, the Premier League themselves allowed it. I don't know if they had any other option, but they've kind of gotten behind that cause. a certain extent, which is one of the most surprising things. The NFL have actually apologised, not to Kaepernick directly, but to African-American players for not listening to them over the years in terms of what they've been trying to say about social injustice. And yet we still have the IOC who are sitting there saying, no, you can't protest. I mean, these sort of things can't happen. Now, in fairness, they say they're not going to censor people's social media or anything like that, but they're saying you're not allowed to protest at the podiums or at the ceremony.
Yeah, as you said earlier on, I just can't see that working. You know, I mean, the more you tell people not to do something.
Exactly. Now, people, the athletes won't listen. They won't. LeBron James was famously told by a commentator in the US to shut up and dribble. You know, LeBron James being the most famous American sports person at the moment, probably. He's been very active as well in recent years. And it was an extraordinary comment. And there's an assumption that, I don't know, sports people should know their place, and I don't know, maybe don't have the brain power, or that they're being manipulated in some way by other forces. They're not. They're people. They have as much a right to an opinion as anybody else, and they've been expressing that in recent times, and I'd expect them to express it in Tokyo. But I say expect them. You made the point at the start, Claire, that they shouldn't be obliged to either. I mean, it's fine if 70% of Olympians who are surveyed in this don't think protests should happen. They don't need to protest, and that's absolutely fine as well. But the other percentage should be allowed to do what they want, I believe, as well.
All right. Well, look, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. We had many more examples to talk about. We might come back to them. And we did mention historical figures there who took a stand for causes they believed in. And one of those is the original of the species, Muhammad Ali, and his opposition to the Vietnam War, which almost cost him everything. Let's go back to 1967 for a moment and hear him arguing about that issue with white college students.
I'm saying you're talking about me about some draft, and all of you white boys are breaking your neck to get to Switzerland and Canada and London. I'm not going to help nobody get something my Negroes don't have. If I'm going to die, I'll die now right here fighting you. If I'm going to die, you my enemy. My enemy is the white people, not Viet Cong or Chinese or Japanese. You my opposer when I want freedom. You my opposer when I want justice. You my opposer when I want equality. You won't even stand up for me in America for my religious beliefs, and you want me to go somewhere and fight, but you won't even stand up for me here at home.
Muhammad Ali there, and my thanks to Owen McDevitt from Second Captains and Sinead O'Carroll, editor at thejournal.ie.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.